Welcome to episode 85 of the Yes for Sequential Comics podcast. And the theme of today, tonight, this afternoon, is race relations, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Every now and then we chat about minorities and sexism and so forth. And I don't think we've ever done a whole show on race, racism, white and blacks and Hispanics and Asians and everyone living together. With their magic rings in comics.
Unity of a Michael Jackson song.
That's right. And it'll be nice to touch on this topic and for me to explain why Chris is a huge racist again for another week.
Brief listeners. Yes, it should be an interesting one. So I've got a whole bunch of different characters and a bit of a brief history, and as I'm sure you have too. But let's get into the news.
Christopher, did you get a chance to see a trailer for an upcoming film coming out of France based on the... Okay, you haven't, obviously. They're making a live-action Masupilami film.
Oh, no, I didn't see the trailer, but I'm aware of that.
This is... the movie's called Huba on the trail of Masupilami. Huba's like the exclamation, this little long-tailed... Yeah, in Scent of a Woman?
Yes, that's
right. Oh, God, that movie's bad. Is that the one where Chris O'Donnell and him go driving in a Ferrari?
You can't see. Best performance since Batman and Robin.
He was good in Little Women.
Hello. That's a bit... you're talking about the movie. Yes.
Oh, Chris, no.
I can't believe you just went there.
No. I have to record this from scratch all over again. Well, speaking of little kids, Chris O'Donnell might... go see this film with them. It should be, it should be a fun film for kids. It's based on André Franquin's popular Spiro and Fantasio spin-off series about a very long-tailed jungle cat and a lot of slapstick humor. It's very much an all-ages comic, and the film seems to capture that. So fans of bande dessinée, or however you say it, that's French comics, should check out the trailer if you get a chance. In other little piece of news, Katsuhiro Otomo is returning to writing long-form manga. For the first time in 20 years, I think.
So, what's he been doing with himself?
He's been working in animation for the last 20 years. You might remember Steam Boy came out a few years ago, and he's been producing a whole bunch of shorts and short series and one-off films and so forth. But finally, to come back to comics, it's a nice thing since Akira is one of those breakout hits that he's got his own legacy to live up to, which is always a scary thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, that's true. It's like Ian Thorpe trying to make a comeback in the swimming pool.
Except
hopefully it's not as embarrassing.
I stop bringing up sports. I will have none of that talk on this podcast. But yeah, it'll be serialized in an as yet unspecified shonen magazine and will be set in Japan's Meiji period, which is the late 1860s to 1912, which is the year when Japan transformed from a feudal state into an empire. So it's a very kind of historical period. We don't know anything else about this so far, but I'll be watching this carefully because the first long comic Katsuhiro Otomo's done in ages, so it's exciting. It's exciting for me. What you got, Chris?
Something also as exciting is He-Man.
Not as exciting.
Well, you might remember the He-Man film starring Dolph Lundgren from 1989. Ralph McQuarrie, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago, he sadly passed away, I think, last month, conceptual artist of Star Wars, Cocoon, Tron, whatnot. He was actually asked by the director of He-Man, or director of Master of the Universe, as the film was known, Gary Goddard, who apparently these days is making theme parks and whatnot rather than directing films. But when Cocoon, that Ralph McQuarrie was doing art for, when that was on a brief hiatus, he went and did some concept artwork for the Master of the Universe film, and Gary Goddard, after Ralph McQuarrie died, dug into his archives and put up a bunch of them online. So it's pretty interesting. McQuarrie's art stayed, the characters looked a lot more like the toys and the cartoon, but Skeletor in McQuarrie's vision was a man in a skull mask rather than an actual skeletal being. So I'll put the link up. You can check them out. It's actually pretty interesting. The only other thing I wanted to mention was SwanCon or DoomCon, which is a local Perth sci-fi fantasy convention. Runs every year on the April long weekend. So that's going to be at the Pan Pacific Hotel from April 5th to 9th. If you're actually in Perth, please drop by. Myself, will be speaking on Friday at lunchtime at a panel with a couple of other people, as well as Friday night, and also be doing a live podcast on Sunday night with a couple of other Perth podcasters. So I'll be representing the Extra Sequential duo.
You better not embarrass me, seriously.
No, you can do that all by yourself, I'm sure. But no, I'm looking forward to it, and always good to meet new people. So, one of the panels I'm talking about is kind of comics for newbies, and the other panel is the DC relaunch and how it has worked or not worked, as the case may be or is. So, it's quite an honour. So hopefully drop on by if you're in the area. I'll be the guy with glasses and a blue shirt.
A guy with glasses and blue shirt at a comics convention.
Correct. So, I won't be in costume. I'll probably be wearing shoes without socks. So just look out for anyone in that general description.
Confront anyone with that description and hug them straight away. That's how Chris will know it's you. Otherwise, yes. There's no point. The other news item I had here was that Warner Brothers have appealed the earlier out-of-court settlement with the Heirs.
Yes.
Bloody notes. My spelling's atrocious. And they now want to take the case to open court. Warner Brothers obviously wants the whole pie, no question. They want to get as much ownership of this character as possible. And understandably, I mean, their new film's set to come out soon.
Next year, but yes.
Yeah. And obviously the court case won't be resolved by then, but it might open things up for a sequel and other payoffs and licensing fees. I'm sure they're playing a long-term strategy here, but it's interesting to see that they settled and now have gone, Bally's, we've unsettled.
Yeah.
Bally's is an Australian thing. Don't worry.
Uncle would be the equivalent, I guess. Wouldn't it be?
Uncle.
Like when someone's beating you up, it's like, uncle, isn't it give up? Isn't that the same
thing? Bally's isn't give up. Bally's is like, timeout. That's Bally's.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Obviously, I didn't get into as many schoolyard scrapes as a young larrikin Leakerton.
You were more of a library kind of guy. I was too.
I found a daylight. Let's talk about what we've been reading.
Let's do that. What did you read this week, Chris?
Well, you'll be happy and proud because I've been reading a webcomic, which is something I very rarely do.
That is rare.
Talk to women.
Yeah.
So I don't know how I found this, but it's called Little League, and it's basically a...
it's about superheroes, isn't it?
You know it, yes. Yeah. It's kind of like Tiny Titans, where it's the Justice League. So Tiny Titans is the Teen Titans in preschool, and this is like the Justice League as schoolyard kind of. So it's actually really funny. It updates twice a week. I'll put the link up. I highly recommend it. So Bruce Wayne is very gloomy, and Superman is upbeat, and Martian Manhunter is the new kid for an exchange student, and Bruce loves time out because he gets to sit in the corner, by himself. Time out. It's like a brooding smorgasbord. And then when Wonder Woman touches Superman, Bruce gives Clark an anti-cootie serum. And it's all just, and then Darkseid rocks up as the physical ed teacher in little white shorts. Mr. Schwartz is the teacher, who's Julius Schwartz, one of the longtime DC Comics editors. So, it's actually really funny, very cute. So, highly recommend it. I've also been reading Atomic Robo Presents Real Science Adventures number 1 from Red Comics, Red 5 Comics. It's a new anthology series spinning off of the wisecracking Nikola Tesla creation. So, the link for that I'll put up online as well, because I've done that for Broken Frontier. I've been watching some episodes of the Young Justice cartoon, which is pretty good, and I've watched 2 foreign films. One is Cell 211, which is a Spanish film, which remake is on the way. And that's pretty interesting in Maladin, where a guy, his first day on the job as a prison guard, there's a riot and he kind of gets injured. So the other guards who are kind of giving the tour don't have time to kind of take him out. So they just lock him in a cell. And then he kind of, to save his life, and he kind of has to take off all his clothes and pretend like he's a prisoner.
Right.
Just so they think he's one of them. So it's like, how far do you go to...
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And the other one I've seen before, but it's called, it's a French comedy called Tatois. English subtitle or translation would be Ruby and Quentin, and it's a kind of a crime comedy with Gerard Depardieu and John Renault. And, it's very, the French do smart comedies, you know, not obvious and stuff. It's all
that, yeah. That we don't want to give the French too much credit here, because the French also do some very broad, stupid slapstick comedies. If you're French, you wouldn't consider that an insult. You'll nod and go, yep. There's that film with Jean Reno and his other squire. They travel forwards in time. They're knights from medieval. Do you know the one? Yeah.
Yes, they remade it as well with Christina Applegate.
Yeah, but they were still playing their same roles, which was interesting.
They were, yes. Yeah. What have you been watching?
Oh, well, I won't mention anything I've been watching, but I've been reading a lot of comics, as always. Just because you mentioned the, what do you call it, Little League?
Yes, Little League comic, yep.
Yeah, this is almost kind of the opposite thing. I read, there's only a couple of issues of it so far, but it's called Hobbs and Bacon. And it's by the guys who do the webcomic Pants Are Overrated. And what they've done is they've checked in on Calvin and Hobbes, you know, when he's in his 30s. So him and Susie are married, and he's got a daughter who he's handed down Hobbes to, hence Hobbes and Bacon. Her name's Bacon for some reason. I don't know. But it's cute to see them using the idea. Obviously, there's a lot of nostalgia and stuff feeding into this. It's more like a little loving tribute, and I'm guessing there's a lot of that in Little League as well. But I thought it's a nice counterpiece to that one. In non-web comics, I read Lock and Key, or the third volume.
Oh, yes, awesome. I've heard good things, but I haven't read much of it.
Mm. Well, I read like volume 3 completely out of order, just because it was in the library. Okay. But It's an interesting comic. It's from IDW, and it's probably the best thing I've seen for them in quite a while. It's about this family who, I don't know if they've just moved in, or because it's third volume, so a little bit, I'm missing a bit of context, but like a single mother and a family, and they're in this very large house, and there's always keys hidden around the places, and the keys do strange things like unlock people's heads so you can put ideas in them, and there's a key that resurrects the dead, you know, and it seems like every so issues they introduce another key, and there's this other guy who's possessing people and trying to get the keys. There's obviously something larger at play, but it's been a lot of fun so far. But it did make me think about the topic of artistic concessions, because there's a lot of panels in this comic where they'll reuse a panel and then just redraw only the arms or the the eyes looking in another direction, almost in a way like in television animation, where to get as little motion as possible. And it's not too jarring, and they use it so often that it seems like a stylistic choice. But it does make me think about the balance of, you know, how would you, Chris, happily accept a few kind of artistic concessions like that, you know, similar looking panels over and over again in a sequence, if the comic comes out more regularly? Or do you prefer it to be perfect?
Well, I'm pretty much a trade waiter these days, so I could wait for it to be perfect.
Mm.
But the art that I have seen by, I think it's Gabriel Rodriguez, I think, who does Lock and Key, written by Stephen King's son, Joe Hill. I think the art, from what I've seen, if it's the same guy in Volume 3 as the first volume, is pretty awesome.
Mm. Oh, the art's really good. It's got its own rhythm reusing those panels. It's not as jarring as, I know you remember a lot of comics from the late 80s, early 90s, they might just repeat 3 or 4 panels of a close-up of you know, whoever the hero is with the same dialogue speech bubble.
Yeah.
It's meant to show, like, time is slowed down or whatever. But it's done pretty well here. It's a choice, I guess. The other comic I read was David Boring by Daniel Klaus. Have you heard of this one?
Okay. I have not.
It's a very impressive comic. Daniel Klaus is a writer of Ghost World, very similar kind of, I don't want to say slice of life, because this is not slice of life, but he's very observant comic illustrator and writer, in that he sort of gets the nuances of how people behave. But this is a crazy story. It's got all these wild, erratic plot lines, and they're all driven by really kind of arbitrary choices some of the characters make. But the central character, David Boring, is obsessed with, well, a few quests. One is finding the perfect ass on the woman who will meet his very specific feminine ideal. And he prides himself on being able to take one look at a woman and know exactly what her ass will look like, you know, from the front to the back. But he's also obsessed with decoding these series of obscure torn pieces of paper, which is the girlfriend who left around in the apartment, and he thinks they're clues to deciphering some hidden message. And then, so he's tracking her down. Meanwhile, his father was a former comics illustrator in the 50s, so he's trying to find these hidden meanings in this, you know, crappy superhero comic from the 50s, seeing if his dad left him any messages. Meanwhile, there's the threat of nuclear Armageddon. There's a string of murders while his family are away on a long weekend vacation. It's a really cool comic. Very different to Ghost World in that this is a lot more kind of like a dream, just going all over the place with crazy ideas. It's a lot of fun. I'd recommend it. Shall we get into this two pick?
We shall.
Christopher?
Yes.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how racist are you?
I would say negative 8.
Oh, so you don't even see colour, do you?
No, I'm colourblind, man.
Yeah. You come out the other end of racism and you're anti-racist. I got it. You know, think very highly of yourself. Fine, whatever. But I was going to say, you can't ask that question, can you? Because there's no right answer. Like, people saying, oh, some of my best friends are black. It's one of the most awkward wrong things you can say. And it just... So, I just want to put a disclaimer at the front of this show. We'll be saying the words black and white.
True.
And I don't know which words are offensive and which aren't in these days, but it would be wrong in Australia to call black people African Americans because they're not Americans and you don't necessarily know they're African. You know, I just want to say, please don't be offended by any terms we use, like cracker or skippy. It's all in love. And if you want to correct us for being racist, please do so at the Exsequential Facebook site. So, no, go, Chris. Go.
Wow, you're playing it safe. You could be a politician. But yes, there's actually quite a long history of black characters, more than any other in regards to race. I mean, I wrote down a few Asian and Hispanic as well, but particularly in superhero comics, I actually found upon my research, I stumbled upon the time Lois Lane, I don't know, in a 50s or 60s comic, because Lois Lane had her own...
I don't like where this is going.
...comic for a while, and she disguised herself... went through some scientific transformation and transformed herself into a black woman to kind of infiltrate some neighbourhood and get info. So we've come along. It reminds me of that Soul Man movie or whatever it was, which surprisingly they've never released on DVD.
I'm wincing.
A similar kind of thing happens. But I think we've come a long way, baby, to quote whatever band that was with the big fat guy wearing on the T-shirt.
Fat Boy Slim.
Thank you.
The question is, have we come far enough? And maybe we'll go some ways to answering that question on tonight's show, I suppose.
It's interesting. I think it's kind of timely as well, because I haven't seen Hunger Games, but I'm planning to next week. But apparently there's been a bit of backlash against this very issue, because according to the book, some characters described as black, some white characters are played by black characters in the film. And some characters in the book who aren't described what race they are. Some people are kind of getting all up in arms about it.
That's a strange one, because the example I heard was a minor character who is described as black, but very briefly in the book, and it's not a major thing. And then people who've seen the film were complaining because they didn't imagine her as black, and you can't change the characters. Okay. And then they're like, but it says here in the book that she's black. But strange things like that, and like the main character, she's described as dark, which could mean anything. She could have dark hair. This is what writers do. They know what they're doing when they write dark. It's vague, nebulous.
I've also noticed a surprising number of replacement characters or replacement superheroes have been, particularly African-American. So you've got, the first two that jumped to my mind were War Machine. So Colonel James Rhodes, who you would have seen in Iron Man 2. And Iron Man, but as War Machine in Iron Man 2, he's also going to show up in Iron Man 3. So he was basically when Tony Stark kind of went off his rocker and was a drunkard, basically James Rhodes, who is Tony's best friend, kind of replaced him in the Iron Man suit, but nobody knew. everybody under the suit for the first few issues still thought he was Tony Stark, and then eventually Tony Stark came back and wanted his armor back, and then James Rhodes became War Machine and got his own black and grey armor with all the weapons and stuff off of it. But that seems to happen a lot, as our white characters are replaced either temporarily or permanently by minority characters. The other major one I thought of was Steel, as portrayed by Shaquille O'Neal. The awesome movie. I use the word awesome ironically. Steel is also showed up in the Superman animated series and the Justice League cartoon. But it's interesting. Like, I was thinking Superman doesn't really, if you compare him to someone like Peter Parker, who's got quite a diverse supporting cast, Superman doesn't necessarily until about the late 80s, mid-90s, when he had Ron Troop, who was an African-American journalist, who was quite a prominent supporting character in the 90s and early 2000s, and Superboy, the original Superboy, who was a clone of Superman, that in the same storyline that introduced Steel. His girlfriend was Hawaiian, Tana Moon, and she was also a TV journalist. But yeah, Steel's an interesting character. He's created by Louise Simonson and artist John Bogdanov, and debuted in Adventures of Superman 500 from 1993. His alter ego is John Henry Irons, who's basically a scientist, and he's kind of, I guess, kind of DC's version of Iron Man, and that is a smart rich guy in a suit. But he was a really good character. He, like Superboy as well, after Superman came back, he spun off into his own series, which ran for 4 years, from 94 to 1998. Then Steel joined the Justice League, and then he retired and built his suit for his niece, Natasha. But yeah, Steel's an interesting character. He's not really around as much these days since the DC relaunch, but he did show up in early issues of Action Comics as a scientist, so hopefully we'll get to see more of him. But yeah, a lot of kind of replacement characters. The other one I thought of is the Ryan Choi, who replaced the Atom. The Atom, you might remember, the guy that can kind of DC's version of Ant-Man or Dwayne, it kind of gets big and small. Well, no, he just gets small, actually. So Ryan Choi was an ex-student of Ray Palmer, and then Ray Palmer, the original Atom, went missing. Ryan Choi took over as the new kind of Asian Atom and got a new costume and all that kind of stuff. Can you think of any?
I can, and well, I'll keep with the theme that you've just mentioned here, which is kind of replacement characters, because it's its own field for a while. And I guess comics have a problem with what's called regressive storytelling. I did a bit of research for this topic. Yeah, there's an article by Chris Sims at Comic Science back from 2010. But okay, the problem with they a lot of the time they'll introduce these characters like Jon Stewart, like who was the replacement Green Lantern, and a lot of the ones you've mentioned, is there is a tendency in comics to retcon back to the original version of a character, which usually means regressing back to an all white male cast, which means a character like Jon Stewart, he's no longer the Green Lantern, he's just a Green Lantern, or if you follow what I mean.
Yeah. So
I guess in a lot of ways these characters kind of get jettisoned to the side, and that's probably something we'll see with the Miles Morales character, who's currently donning the Spider-Man suit. And that's a whole topic in itself. I mean, just to fill people in quickly, if you have not been reading Ultimate Spider-Man lately, Spider-Man died. He's been replaced by is he half Mexican, half African-American?
Half Hispanic, half black. And we should point out that this is the ultimate version of
Dark. I believe I mentioned that, Chris.
Well, people might not know what the ultimate version is. So there's two versions in the Marvel Universe, the ultimate version, which is like a separate dimension, I guess you could say.
And the real one? Is that what
you're...
The real one in quotation marks.
When Miles Morales debuted, heaps of media coverage.
Well, this whole thing came about because of the... Remember the casting rumours that Donald Glover, one of the stars of Community and also a rapper?
I didn't know that. I just found that out, actually. Have you listened to any of his music?
I have. He's all right. He's got good wordplay. I guess that's from his comedic background. But then I know that he was trying to push to get that role, because in one episode he just wears Spider-Man pajamas, and fans saw that and said, "What a great idea!" And well, there was a huge push for that, and you wouldn't believe the kerfuffle from a lot of fans who were like, "Spider-Man cannot be black." And apparently,
Brian Michael Bendis.
Thank you. I was just going to say Michael Bendis, but I'm like, that doesn't make sense.
Michael
Brian Bendis. Yeah, he apparently saw that and he thought, "Hey, that'll work." And he said, I saw him in the costume and I thought, I would like to read that book. So, apparently that's part of the reason why they went into writing that, and probably also because there was buzz about that as well. But as you said, that move's been met with some criticism for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, yeah, Miles Morales has been in the works since about 2008 when Barack Obama became president. So, it was kind of there are rumblings in Marvel that they wanted to make one of their top kind of heroes a minority. And, yeah, Brian Michael Bendis, who's, I think, written every issue of Ultimate Spider-Man before it ended, he, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's got a few adopted kids that are of different minorities as well. So, that's obviously something that was close to his heart. We should point out there's actually a Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon coming out soon, but that will feature the Peter Parker version. So, okay. It's only sharing.
It always will, won't it? Because that's the name that's familiar to people.
I know when Stan Lee created Spider-Man, he said it could be anyone under that suit. Like, Spidey was the first kind of mainstream hero to have his face covered. Like, even Batman has still got his tunic as his skin tone, whereas Spidey, Stan Lee used to say, it could be anyone under it. It could be Indian, it could be, you know, Caucasian, it could be African American, it could be whatever you want.
Okay. Well, no, that does make sense, and that was kind of my opinion, but there is a whole issue of relatability, and we'll get to that later. But, I mean, just with this whole characters taking on the mantle of a more popular hero, it is a little bit working against the idea of having them succeed on their own right. I've heard a lot of people critique it in the just flipping the race of a character is kind of an empty move. Like, the hero needs to succeed on their own account. Otherwise, they'll just always be the replacement Spider-Man, the replacement Atom, you know.
I think so, but I think as Steel proved, he had his own series for 4 years.
But he was different enough, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't have superpowers, he's not an alien, he was just kind of inspired by Superman. So I think Steel is one, I think War Machine is one that works as well. I mean, ideologically, he's very different from Tony Stark.
I know it's Marvel, a two-headed thing, for sure. What were you going to say, Marvel?
I think Marvel have done better at this than DC. DC had to kind of make an effort, especially in the last few years. Dan Didio, who's the head honcho or one of the head honchos of DC, who just celebrated his 10 years, actually, as the top of DC Comics. One of the things he wanted to do when he first came in was introduce more minorities, and that's why we got the Asian Atom. We had, you know, the lesbian Batwoman and you know, the Hispanic Blue Beetle, which we'll talk about later. So we had more of those. So it seems to be more of a push at DC, whereas Marvel have been doing this kind of thing prominently since the 70s. And Black Panther was the first one who really, the first mainstream superhero who wasn't a white guy.
I guess Marvel don't have the... I guess it's a burden and a blessing that DC have these characters with such a long history that there isn't a lot of freedom to change things around except to give them new sidekicks. And even that, you know, Batman could have a million sidekicks, but if Dick Grayson isn't somewhere in the wings, people will usually complain. And if there's a retcon, Dick Grayson always ends up being Robin again. It's never going to be Muhammad Ahmed. You know,
that is true.
Yeah, but there's a quote, another quote here. I mean, the success of Miles could prove to be a positive force in the marketing of non-white superheroes and lead to these original characters that many fans are speaking out about. So these characters who are taking over, Spider-Man and well-known characters, there are benefits there. It isn't all just the negative way, and they'll disappear once they have to take off that costume. As you mentioned with Steel, I don't even associate him with Superman in my mind a lot of the time. So,
no, and same with War Machine. He's a character who's, you know, formed his own life and had his own title. He's, for a while there, he was kind of like the Venom of the Marvel Universe, and then he'd pop up everywhere. You know, he's like a superhero with guns on his costume. How cool is that? I did want to get back to Black Panther because I mentioned
this. Please. Yeah.
So he was created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. 1966 he debuted, and this was just before the kind of Black Panther movement, because a lot of people kind of think they stole the name off the Black Panther kind of movement. But no, so he debuted in 1966, Fantastic Four number 52. And as I said, the first kind of black superhero, effectively. He's King T'Challa of Wakanda, which is a made-up, obviously, African nation. He's been an Avenger. He married Storm of the X-Men, another African character a couple of years ago. And then he basically passed his panther mantle onto his sister, Shuri, and he kind of lost his powers, and then he took over Daredevil's duties in Hell's Kitchen. But, yeah, Black Panther's kind of been risen in prominence, being a member of the Avengers, and then he's been in the Earth's Mightiest Heroes cartoon, and he's been in quite a few of the animated films that Marvel have done recently.
Is he headlining his own title right now?
No, I don't believe so. He did take over the Daredevil series for a while, and then that ended maybe 2 months ago.
Okay.
But I don't know if he's coming back or what. But Marvel, much like DC, cancelled about half a dozen of the series at the start of the year, including Ghost Rider and a few others, and Black Panther was one of those.
How long ago was Luke Cage cancelled? No.
Character of Black Panther is still around. Yeah, Luke Cage is, I think he's had his series or mini-series over the years rather than his own ongoing series.
He never has anything ongoing, but, yeah, I was trying to remember when that was cancelled. I guess that was a mini, so that was probably due to be ending at some point anyway.
Yeah, Luke Cage was more of a kind of streetwise tough guy. You might remember when he first debuted in 1972, he wore
I remember.
Blouse kind of thing. We'll just say, sweet Christmas. Superheroes don't have catchphrases anymore. They're just relegated to characters and sitcoms. Anyway, so Luke Cage is popular again. Brian Michael Bendis really brought him to prominence because he was kind of one of those characters that Marvel didn't do anything with for years and years.
I've got a catchphrase here for the Thing.
It's clobber and time?
No. You've just been fingered. So, please continue.
Maybe if you're starring in an adult movie. It's not something you want to scream on the middle of New York City when you're fighting aliens. Luke Cage teamed with Iron Fist. So, he's a white guy, I believe. Yeah, Danny Rand. He's been the most prominent in the new Avengers. So he's basically a guy, I think he was a wrongly incarcerated man, and then he was experimented on and he got tough skin and kind of super strength. So, he had a kid with Jessica Jones, who's a Caucasian woman who used to be a superhero but now is a private investigator or something. Luke Cage is one of the most prominent kind of African-Americans in Marvel. It's interesting, kind of before Luke Cage, a lot of these guys had black in front of their name, which is kind of interesting. So you had Black Manta, who's the Aquaman bad. He had Black Lightning, who's one of my favourite superheroes, I've got to say, one of the kind of C-listers or D-listers. Black Lightning was the first DC one that was kind of first DC African-American superhero, Jefferson Pierce, and he's basically got lightning powers, and he's a pretty interesting character, but again, not much has been done with him recently. So I've got Black Panther, who I've mentioned. But you've got Black Racer, who's the personification of death, who basically, I think he like claims people's souls in the DC universe when they die, and he's basically a guy on skis.
I don't know why.
Yeah, but not all blacks. Can you tell me two superheroes who have black in their name but aren't African-American? I bet you can't. I want to prove how smart I am.
Black Widow?
Oh, yes, there's one more.
Black Canary?
Yes.
Yes. See, I'm not a fool. I have read some superhero comics before, Chris.
Both white females, yes. Falcon is another interesting one. He doesn't have black in his name. He was created in 1969 by Stan Lee and Gene Colan. His alter ego is Sam Wilson. And I think, he was the first character to not have black in his name, so he kind of started it. He was just a normal guy. I don't think he has any superpowers, but he was trained by and kind of partnered with Captain America. He was basically just a do-gooder trying to clean up his neighborhood, I believe. And then I think the Red Skull kind of messed with him with the Cosmic Cube, and he now has an empathic link with his bird Falcon, with his bird Red Wing and other birds, and he can see through their eyes. He can't fly. He has like this kind of high-tech flight harness, but he doesn't have any superpowers as such, but he's most often teamed with Captain America.
You mentioned all these characters of black in front of their name,
yes.
And I guess it's part of that. We laugh about it now, but I guess at the time, seeing any black protagonists in anything, television, film, would still be very rare. I mean, you mentioned early 60s there, and even then would have been quite unusual, unless if it was targeted specifically for black audiences. And I'm sure some of these were, but it wasn't exclusively so. I guess comics are a small enough field that you can do other things if people put their mind to them. But yeah, it's easy to dismiss these characters for having silly names, but then you have to remember, well, we should give them some credit for at least for writing Black lead characters. But most of them, as you mentioned, were probably written by white writers, I should say. So
definitely,
yeah.
I guess the interesting thing would be the Milestone universe comics that DC were published by DC Comics in the 90s. And if you pick up the Justice League Doom, you'll find an interesting documentary on the history of that. Dwayne McDuffie, who wrote the animated film, recently passed away, so I've got a tribute to him. But, Static Shock is one of the most heroes kind of DC's version of Spider-Man, in that as a kind of young, poor teen, wisecracking hero. Static Shock, Virgil Hawkins is his alter ego, created in 1993 by Dwayne McDuffie and John Paul Leon. Eventually he crossed over with a few other Milestone characters into the DC Universe regular and joined the Teen Titans. And then again he had his solo series both before and after the New 52, but unfortunately it was cancelled after issue 8, which I think must be next month. But he also had a cartoon which ran for 2000 and 2004, and the adult version of Static Shock showed up in Batman Beyond, I believe, and Justice League Unlimited. So, yeah, he was kind of the Milestone. It was an imprint that basically was African-American creators creating African-American mainly characters, kind of their own kind of superhero, more kind of urban, less far-fetched kind of universe. And that was pretty interesting. So, I mean, it doesn't really exist anymore, and Static Shock has been the only kind of crossover character. He kind of has lightning powers. I can't remember his origin at the moment, but yeah, Milestone was certainly an interesting imprint, and good on DC for trying that in the 90s.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Dwayne McDuffie there, and there's a great YouTube interview with him where he talks about the problems of being a black-white, I keep saying black-whiter. Isn't that wonderful, ebony and ivory together? But a black writer as well. But yeah, he's saying, when he moved on to writing Justice League, he had to deal with the fact that what he felt that white audiences, a lot of them were kind of poised to find some excuse to say that he was trying to, these are the words he used, shove my agenda down their throat. So even though he came on at a point where DC had already made plans to introduce three black characters to Justice League, he ended up taking flack for it in that people were accusing him of, you know, some black agenda, and which is quite strange. It's this opposite reaction to what would be nice, considering it's a league of people. But he was saying there's this weird idea that if you have more than two black characters on, it's on a TV show, he was talking about the example, it becomes a black show. So one character is fine. You know, usually we'll see one black character. Two is a stretch, apparently. And I was trying to think through some examples which weren't considered like black shows, like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and so forth, of like ensemble shows which have more than two black characters. It's quite rare. And yeah, have you noticed that? Because I was thinking, even a show like Glee, and that was the first one that came to mind, because I'm like, oh, they're the We Love Everything, we Love Everything and Everyone show.
Yeah.
You know, the show about being yourself where they do covers of popular songs?
Yes, I know the song. Well, I love that Out of Touch, thanks, Grandpa.
But on that one, there's one main black character.
But I've got a kid in a wheelchair as well.
Kid in a wheelchair, and then about nine white kids.
Boxes. Nine.
Well, most of them are white kids, and there's one Asian girl. So,
okay.
Well, now might be a good chance. We'll come back to more African American examples, but
sure.
If you're looking for any Asian,
I've got a couple.
Yeah, they're far rarer, I've found.
They are, but they've been cropping up more recently as of late. So I mentioned the Asian Atom, Ryan Choi, who kind of well briefly. and I think hopefully these characters would still be around if it wasn't for the New 52. I mean, they may not get their own series, but, you know, they'd like to. Anyway, Amadeus Cho is an interesting one. He's a, yeah, it's interesting kind of that the black characters, as I've noticed, are kind of come from the streets and are tough, and the Asian characters are usually known for their smarts.
And their kung fu.
So, it's kind of interesting. But yeah, that's been the case. They're either like good or science or maths or something. But
yeah, you're not too.
So Albert Astro is certainly that. He was basically 18, kind of psychic, kind of a younger version of Sheldon, I guess, like a bit of a kid genius. So he was basically a psychic in Hulk's series, and then basically when the Hulk series became Hercules, he then helped Hercules. He was actually a very interesting, created by Greg Pak, who I believe is Asian as well. So he's a pretty interesting character. And the other one that I've actually just been reading this week from the library is Agents of Atlas, which was Marvel's attempt to kind of bring back a bunch of 40s and 50s characters, superheroes, back into the kind of mainstream Marvel universe. And they are led by James Wu. And he's kind of a de-aged kind of version. He's kind of, I guess he could be kind of an agent, kind of an anti-hero. He's kind of a bit scheming and stuff, but and he's the leader. He's basically just a smart Asian man in his 20s. He doesn't appear to be, you know, a scientific genius or anything necessarily, but he's quite good and quite a well-rounded character, and it's actually quite an interesting. So they've got two volumes of Agents of Atlas at the library, so I think I'll read the both of them. Hmm. The only other one that I thought of that came to mind, well, actually a couple more, was if they're not good at maths and science, then they're definitely good at martial arts. Hmm. The DC Universe is famous for that. So Green Arrow, the second Green Arrow, which was Connor Hawke, the son of the original Oliver Queen, and Moonday Hawke, who was some hippie chick that Oliver Queen slept with because he's a bit of a playboy. Cassandra Cain, the mute Batgirl, who also had her solo series, a fantastic character. I think we both loved her.
Mm.
Lady Shiva, who I believe trained Bruce Wayne after he got his back broken in Nightfall. So those are kind of all good Asian characters that are known for their martial arts. And the other one that came to mind was Katana, created by Mike W. Barr and Jim Aparo, and I think the 1980 series Batman and the Outsiders. Mm. And she's just joined the Birds of Prey in the DC's New 52. And she's actually going to be showing up. She showed up in the Batman Brave and the Bold, and she's also going to be apparently be Batman's sidekick instead of Robin in the new CGI Beware the Batman cartoon that's going to show up on TV screens at some point later this year. But, yeah, those are all kind of Asian characters that are kind of smart and good at kung fu.
Well, it's worth noting that a lot of these characters have kind of popped up on or after a more, it's been normalized, say, by Bruce Lee, as an example, became hugely popular with all sorts of audiences. And after his popularity and the kind of popularity of Hong Kong, you know, chop suey films, there was all of a sudden, you know, kung fu fighting characters in comics. And the same as you mentioned, like Black Lightning and all these other characters, but Luke Cage is pretty clearly kind of referencing the,
Shaft and those kind of films.
Part of it is just commercially driven, so there's always that aspect to it. But so few of these characters ever seem to headline their own series, or if they are, it's under the title of a more well-known character. And then, as you mentioned, once you have a reboot, everything goes back to the white characters. So whoever's been, well, the original character, that was mean to say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's because – I don't think handle their own series. I think it's just most people – it's so hard to launch any new superhero series.
Mm.
It's just – even Marvel and DC, I mean, we've seen DC have launched, you know, 52 new series, and they've already cancelled half a dozen of them after the eight-month mark. I mean, that's like DC Comics, the second – biggest, you know, publishing comics on the planet. So if it's not Superman or Batman or X-Men or Spider-Man or whatever, it's going to struggle no matter what ways they are.
Yeah, I think maybe a larger part of it is with minority characters. I don't want to say just black characters or Asian characters or whatever. If they're headlining their own series, typically what you'll find is a part of their storyline will involve how they feel about their race. It's usually unavoidable, except in some of these older comics, surprisingly enough, it was glossed over a lot more. Once they put on the costume, no one cared too much a lot of the time. But maybe it's a case of white audiences who do make up who for now do seem to make up the majority of the comic buying public, and to the sometimes to the exclusion of others if they want to keep all their characters white, I guess. But they do react strongly. As Dwayne McDuffie said, you know, he felt that he was being attacked for trying to push his agenda on people. And he's just like, look, I'm just writing a character. Get off my ass. So part of it seems to be this perception problem of people expecting a black comic character lead to have a certain content that they maybe just don't feel they're interested in or want to relate to. Whereas if you look at successful African-American leads in films or Will Smith's always a good example because he's beloved by audiences of all races and colors, you know?
Yes.
And very rare. I mean, I don't think anything's made of the fact in Men in Black that he's black, is it?
No.
Does anyone even notice? And that's the kind of thing. It's sometimes it's good when the comic just sort of gets on with it. No one even comments that, hey, you're Asian. How come you don't know Kung Fu? You know, like in that movie with Dolph Lundgren and Bruce Lee's son, that piece.
I was going to say Jet Li, but he's the director.
Yeah.
Jason Lee.
Bruce Lee's son, Jet Li. That doesn't sound right to me.
Jason Scott Lee. Yeah. Is it? No, it's another guy.
Jason. It is Jason.
Brandon.
Yeah, Jason Scott Lee played Bruce Lee.
That's it.
Confusing. Did you see that movie where Bruce Lee goes through the seven layers of hell and fights an Asian 007 and an Asian Darth Vader and stuff? Check that one out. I'll put it up on the Facebook site. It's a crazy movie with one of the Bruce Lee imitators, you know, the ones who had a similar name. Yeah, crazy movie. Sorry to get off topic.
It's like L-I.
Yes, exactly. Sorry to get off topic, I guess, there. But, it is kind of having the lead be a particular race. Maybe people are on edge some of the time. That's why Batwing's cancelled already, isn't it? Batman of Africa.
Yes.
Even saying it out loud sounds freaking stupid. Yeah, but I've got a quote from Michael Brian Bendis. He's saying that even though there's some amazing African American and minority characters bouncing around in all the superhero universes, it's still crazy lopsided. And I'm inclined to agree.
I was just thinking when the Green Lantern film came out starring Ryan Reynolds, and there was kind of the uproar on that because people didn't know that Green Lantern was actually white because they knew the John Stewart version who you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, because he was in the cartoon, wasn't he?
In the Justice League cartoon, which most people will be familiar with, John Stewart, who was an architect, much like yourself.
Mm. Well, that's the interesting thing because he's a more interesting character than Hal Jordan.
Yeah.
In that he's a bit more unusual. There's so many comic book characters from the early era who are freaking test pilots or they work for the army. It's nice to have someone. I'm just an architect, you know.
Yes.
And the fact that, you know, with the whole, we've got to reboot things back to their roots in the 1940s to appeal to, I don't know who would be that. You know, who's that specific about who these characters have to be? But considering the character might have been more popular or the film might have been more noticeable and people would have seen, ooh, I might see this, a black superhero film.
Well, I guess another couple of interesting ones from Marvel would be Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., who was debuted as white and then they changed his race to...
played by David Hasselhoff.
Played by David Hasselhoff, yes. I haven't seen that film, have you?
It was a TV pilot, wasn't it?
It was.
And then they released it as a movie straight to VHS. If someone has the VHS copy, please send it to us and we'll do an audio commentary.
Watch it on YouTube in 10 parts or something.
I'm sure.
But, yeah, so Nick Fury was a kind of a super spy, kind of debuted in, what, the 60s. And when Marvel debuted the Ultimate Universe, which, as I mentioned before, was kind of an alternate universe, more streamlined, more accessible in 2002, they said, oh, let's make Nick Fury black, and they modelled him on Samuel L. Jackson. Mm-hmm. Thus, we see Samuel L. Jackson playing the character in the Iron Man films and the Avengers. And it's even referenced within the pages of the Ultimates by Mark Millar that you'll see Nick Fury kind of saying, if anyone's going to play me, it's going to be Samuel L. Jackson. And apparently Samuel L. Jackson is a big fan of that, so it's pretty cool. And we have to mention the black Captain America, which debuted in Robert Morales.
Say it right. Say his name right.
Isaiah Bradley.
No.
Yeah.
It's Blacked what? In America.
In 2003's Truth, Red, White, and Black miniseries, where basically, so, yeah, again, some people were kind of angry because they didn't know where this fitted in the timeline, but basically Isaiah Bradley was, well, he wasn't, I think Marvel kind of backtracked to the, he wasn't the precursor to Captain America, but he was kind of, they injected him with the super soldier serum because they wanted more people like Captain America kind of running around. But he hasn't really showed up. But he did show up in the Storm and Black Panther's wedding, apparently. And his grandson in the Marvel Universe is Elijah Bradley, who is known as Patriot in the Young Avengers. There you go.
Now I know.
A couple of other black characters that are crucial we're going to talk, who have gone from white to black, would be Michael Holt, who's the black Mr. Terrific, who has his own series in the New 52. Shiloh Norman, who is the black Mr. Miracle, which I think Grant Morrison did him in the Seven Soldiers of Victory, or whatever it was called. Jason Rush, who's the black Firestorm. He's actually the third Firestorm, the guy who's kind of the flame heads and has the nuclear powers after Ronnie Raymond and Martin Stein, who's the original. The Firestorm also has his own series in the New 52, and essentially two people, so it's Ronnie Raymond and Jason. And I guess the other one, obvious one, would be Crispus Allen, who is the black version of Spectre, God's kind of agent of vengeance.
Now, he's an interesting one. Sorry, go on.
Well, he's kind of like an albino African-American, so he's a black cop.
He's a good one to bring up because he wasn't a superhero originally.
No.
He was part of the expanded cast of in Batman's world. He was in Gotham Central, a comic by Greg Ruka, and that's the best as I can do off memory. Probably George Michael Bendis. Whatever names come to mind is just going to be Steve Michael Bendis. I'm sure he had nothing to do with this comic, but. Yeah, he was a detective in that and he was turned into a superhero. So I guess it's even picking up characters who were kind of unique and defined on their own and putting them in a former white hero's role kind of gives them credence. It's very strange.
Yeah, the same happened to Renee Montoya, actually, now that I think about it, because she replaced Jim Corrigan. She replaced The Question. It became The Question.
Right.
And she's a Hispanic woman,
Woman, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unusual. I wonder if part of it is, it's probably to do with the fact that a comic probably won't sell unless if it's got a familiar enough title on it, especially a minority character. So I don't want to read some racist agenda into this where there isn't one due.
No, I think it's just Marvel and DC are just trying to. They know how diverse their readership is, and they're not they're not silly. They know that. There has to be diversity within their pages,
But there's less of it now, so, yeah.
That did what I mentioned was Blue Beetle, who's Jamie Reese, or Jaime, as apparently is the proper pronunciation, if to believe the Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon. He is actually kind of a young teenager who debuted after Infinite Crisis or Final Crisis. Basically, there's been two Blue Beetles before him, but he's kind of the first one to kind of have like this alien scarab attached to his back and gets kind of superpowers from it. He also showed up in live action form in the last season of Smallville with Booster Gold, did as well. And I think they were filming his own TV pilot, but I don't know what is happening with that. I did want to mention Maladdin. The 1970s, there were a couple of two interesting things, which I'm sure you can't. Yeah, you won't be able to.
I've been doing well so far. I've gotten all of your other questions. I got your Tom Hanks question last week, and I got your Black Widow ones. Yeah, you asked about Turner and Hooch and
K-9. Trent Reznor's Top Dog.
Yeah, so who knows? Brother. I could surprise you a third time.
There was a cartoon in the 70s based on DC Comics characters that introduced quite a lot of diverse minority characters. Ooh. Any clues?
Based on DC?
Yes.
I don't know. The only one I can think of is Super Friends. So.
Correct. which ran for years and years, like I think about 15, 20 years from the 70s to the 80s. Super Friends, and then it became, I think, Super Powers, Galactic Guardians, something. So it had all many different iterations, basically based on the Justice League. Mm. So you had characters in the last couple of years. You had Black Vulcan, there was basically a stand-in for Black Lightning because Hanna-Barbera didn't want to pay the licensing fee. You had Apache Chief, who was Native American Indian, who basically would say, "You look chook," and then he'd grow large. He hardly spoke at all during the series. Cyborg, who is very prominent in the DC Universe, and currently a member, I just burped to them, currently a member of the Justice League in the New 52, and also shows up in the Justice League Doom movie that I mentioned. And he was introduced in the 80s in the Teen Titans comic. And then you had El Dorado and Samurai. So yeah, it's quite interesting. These are all characters created for the animated series. Mm. Also in the 70s, the all-new, all-different X-Men debuted, which is Giant Size X-Men 1, written by Len Wein and David Cockrum. And this was basically a whole bunch of new different X-Men characters kind of were exploded onto the pages. So this is quite a pivotal time in the history of the X-Men. In the 1975, I believe it was. So you had a lot of his characters aren't still around anymore, but you had Sunfire, who's a Japanese mutant. You had Thunderbird, who's another Apache, and I think died shortly thereafter. Banshee, who's Irish-American. I don't know, Irish can't really be called a whatchamacallit. But, yeah, it's kind of it's almost like the Star Trek. So there's like... It's like so many different nationalities. Colossus debuted, Nightcrawler, and then, as I mentioned, Storm is still around, obviously, and Wolverine. So, yeah, Giant Size X-Men number one certainly introduced a couple of different minorities. So that was kind of an interesting time. I guess we should mention Aqualad as well. He's an interesting character. Originally Tempest or Garth, but now from going from a white character to a black character, again, it's called Jackson Hyde, and he was introduced in the Brightest Day miniseries from 2010, I believe, and then is now currently leading the Young Justice cartoons. He is basically an African-American Atlantean, so that's quite an interesting pedigree. But, yeah, he's a pretty cool character with a nice costume and kind of hard water powers and whatnot. Mm. And we should give a shout-out to Jenny on Facebook, who I believe mentioned a while ago, Spawn. Now, I don't think either one of us is very familiar with Spawn, the Todd McFarlane creation from Image Comics, who is still going strong. I don't know, but a couple of years ago, I guess, Al Simmons, who was the original Spawn, a black guy, decapitated himself because he was becoming evil or something, and then at the same time, Jim Downing, who was a guy in a coma, woke up and became the new Spawn. That's about all I know. That's kind of where we get a guy going from black to white.
It's an interesting reversal of the. The examples you've mentioned so many examples of characters sort of that either their mantle getting taken over by a black character or some equivalent to that. And there's so many that it seems like a trope on its own. And I never even considered it to be a trope. I didn't think it was that common, but apparently it is. I'm very impressed. But you mentioned teams there quite a bit, and the 70s seems to be the point where you began to see, I guess, after the original Star Trek series, the impact of that, of having a multicultural team, because in that one, a Russian officer on their ship during the height of the Cold War, have to remember, it was an intentional choice to say, look, we can all get along.
And the first... televised
interracial kiss,
correct?
Yeah, between Uhura and
Spock and Sulu. Sulu is actually gay, isn't he? Oh, oops, sorry, George Takei. Yes, between
oh my, that's his thing, isn't it? That's what he said,
yes,
yeah. But you mentioned obviously the Super Friends characters, and that sort of continued on. And a lot of the time with these stories, I've noticed that. If there is a main character, they do tend to be white. Whoever's the leader of their gang will usually be a white guy, which is a little bit odd, I guess.
I guess the only other one I could think of would be, as I said, Agents of Atlas. What's his name? James Wu. But, yes, you're right.
Mm. One series which kind of bucks that trend a bit is Runaways, which is Brian K. Vaughan's series. Fantastic one from Marvel. Joss Whedon took over it for a while, and I don't think it's still continuing at the moment. I could be wrong. But initially there was it's a teen runaway superhero team, basically, with slightly strange powers anyway. But just to give a bit of context, but initially they had a black male leader, and then when he stepped down, the Asian American girl in the team became their leader, and she's stayed on for the whole book. And it's interesting because in the book they even call attention to it, because when Alex steps down, that's the name of the original black character, Chase, who's the white male, kind of just assumes he's the next logical choice.
Okay.
And I'm sure it's also, you know, the fact that a lot of readers would also think, well, I guess, yeah, of course the white male is going to be the leader. And then everyone in the comic points out why, you know, she's much better at leading us than you are. What's the point? But the film version of this comic, which has sort of been in pre-production for a while,
Yes. There
were casting calls for it. I found this interesting. Her race was unspecified in the casting calls, as opposed to Alex was specified as an African-American male. All the other characters were described, you know, fine. Hers was non-specific, and it is something that you see that while you may be seeing a lot more black characters, Asian lead protagonists in any film is very, very rare. Like, you will very rarely see, Training Day or, you know, kind of film Denzel Washington or Will Smith would be in being led by an Asian lead. It's very
unusual. Unless it's a kung fu movie.
Unless it's a kung fu movie, exactly.
Yeah.
But this condition of not specifying the race is what specifically led to the problems in The Last Airbender movie.
And Akira.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, that one, they don't want any Asian leads in that, which is really frustrating. But all the Asian characters in Last Airbender were made white, from what I remember. So I suspect that if Runaways does get made, because the female Asian is the leader of the team, one or two things seems inevitable. Either they will cast an Asian-American actress, but Chase, who's the white male, will become the leader in the film, or she'll be made Caucasian. Maybe I'm pessimistic, but it just seems like that's probably what's going to happen. Because I can't think of...
That is interesting. Yeah. I mean, with Hollywood, I thought a couple of films where white characters in comics became black actors was... Lawrence Fishburne is playing Perry White in the Superman film.
But he's not the lead, you know? He's just a minor character in...
True.
Yeah, it's difficult. He's not the leader of any... I mean, he runs a newspaper. It's not like he's the leader of a superhero crew. That I guess that's the difference. You'll always see minor characters be switched around and made, you know, because they're the ones who can survive the shift. His whole existence depends on Superman. He's not like Jimmy Olsen, where he can have a crazy wild comic. But even Jimmy Olsen comics, he's always catching up with Superman. So you'd never read a Perry White comic.
True. And Billy Dee Williams played Harvey Dent in the first Tim Burton Batman film in 1999.
But which would have been the coolest
to the role for Batman.
But that would have been the coolest thing, because that was his understanding when he signed on for that first film, that they'll bring him on to play Two-Face later on. And apparently the studios weren't happy and wanted him recast. Which would have... He would have been so unusual and amazing in that role, I've got to say. You know,
unexpected.
Yeah, he'd be today's... You know how Carl Weathers is very fondly remembered?
Whereas
Billy Dee Williams, probably not so much. You know, it could be the other way around. Alternate universe where Nicolas Cage's Superman got made and Billy Dee Williams actually starred as Two-Face in Tim Burton's Batman 3. Think about that for a second.
You can only imagine.
Well, I guess if Tim Burton made Batman 3, he wouldn't have had time for Nicolas Cage's Superman movie. So he was supposed to direct that, wasn't he?
What's that?
Well, he was supposed to direct that movie, wasn't he? Tim Burton?
Tim Burton? You could be right there. Mm. Yeah. Because Kevin Smith wrote the first screenplay and that didn't go anywhere.
So instead we got neither. Neither of those films are made by Tim Burton.
Mm.
Sadness. But I kind of, if we're closing out here...
Yeah, I've got nothing left.
Perfect. There's one character who I sort of think...
Knives Chow from Scott Pilgrim.
Well, okay, yes, her too. She's like a weird...
It's all been superhero comics.
It has, and it's helped because we could be here all day. But, you know, in mainstream comics, it's also almost more helpful because they're the ones which are read by the most people. But one character who I think can survive being perceived as any race, and I think most people do perceive him as whatever their race is I want you to guess, who is it? He's a comic book and an animation character.
Oh, blimey. Mickey Mouse?
It is Mickey Mouse.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what? Okay.
Yeah.
Explain yourself, sir.
He's a freaking mouse for one. His entire body is black with a white face. And I know that came out of in a time where they were animating black and white cartoons.
Oh, yes.
I know that early on, apparently there was, you know, audiences of any race and any other country. He translated very well to Europe, to, you know, South America, everywhere. They immediately projected themselves onto this character. So race doesn't necessarily need to be an issue. It's not like Mickey Mouse ever points out that he's a white mouse, because he's clearly not. He's a black mouse. He's a black mouse.
It reminds me of the Simpsons episode where I can't remember, but Homer Simpson was watching advertising on TV and goes, "Oh, I'm a white male aged between 18 to 35. Everybody cares what I think."
And he's yellow on that show, which is even freaking stranger. And we didn't have time to mention the whole kerfuffle with the EC Comics and the battle with the Comics Code, but suffice it to say, the Comics Code did play a role in suppressing the number of the way minority characters would be portrayed in comics. Yeah, I can mention it briefly. In the comic Judgment Day, which is a story in, I think, Suspenseful Tales, the twist at the end of this story, and the story is a science fiction one, this masked astronaut arrives on this alien world, he inspects everything, and he decides you're not ready yet to join our intergalactic alliance because there's still problems of racism on your world. And at the end, he removes his helmet and it's revealed he's a black man. All right. That's the whole point of the comic. And the Comics Code hated that and they demanded he be changed. And William Gaines threatened to sue them because he was like, that's the whole point of the comic. You idiots. It'd be nice if these problems didn't exist, but they do. Chris has just dropped out of Skype. So we'll wrap up the show here. He's probably listening in here. See if I bitch about him and his weird Kermit the Frog voice. Hey, Chris. You can catch further Exosequential shows at exosequential.com, as well as hit us up on Facebook and iTunes. You can email Chris at exosequential.com with comments and check out music for the show at purgeaudit.com. And if you have any suggestions for a future show, let us know at the Facebook. Thanks, everyone. Chris sends his kind racist regards. Mladen signing off. Bye.